Welcome back to Generals and Napoleon, episode 78, The Library of Napoleon. Before we begin, I'd like to remind all of our wonderful listeners that if they'd like to support our podcast, please go to patreon.com/Generals and Napoleon. There, you'll find ad-free bonus content and previews of upcoming episodes. As always, we appreciate our current patrons and we look forward to adding more. If you'd like to support our podcast in other ways, please go to YouTube, find our podcast, and hit the subscribe button. If you like our podcast, please go to Spotify, Apple, or anywhere podcasts are heard, and give us a review. We appreciate your assistance. Now, on with the show. We have a very, very, very special guest joining us on the phone. We have Louis Sarkozy, an author of a new book called Napoleon's Library, The Emperor, His Books, and Their Influence on the Napoleonic Era. Louis, how are you?
I'm good, John. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for joining the call. Yeah, how did you, I mean, this is a very exciting book. I can't wait to read it because I always read about Napoleon whenever he was on his campaigns throughout his life. Actually, even in boarding school and the military school, he always had a large collection of books with him. And I always wondered, you know, what are those books? What was he reading becoming this great leader? And maybe your book can give us some insight on that.
Well, I sure hope so. And the short answer to your question is that he was reading everything. and I mean, he forever puts to rest that old excuse that we've all heard saying, oh, you know, I wish I could read more, but I can't. I don't have the time.
Right.
Well, he was the last monarch to lead armies in battle himself, obsessing over every details of his campaigns, of his armies, logistically, strategically, also governing France at a very tumultuous period in her history, as you well know. And despite that, he read constantly. And I mean constantly. And he read everything. He read predominantly history. He's a huge, huge fan of history, but also politics, law, philosophy, religion, music, and novels. A surprising amount of novels. He was a great fan of the pre-romantic love stories of Rousseau and others and Goethe, which made him swoon and cry. And he loved these novels. It's a very touching side of his character that I wish more people knew.
Indeed. Yeah. And I think it's interesting. You just automatically assume, oh, well, he probably read military history books all the time, but that wasn't the case, was it?
Yeah, listen, it certainly constituted the bulk of his readings, history, I mean. He was a huge fan of Plutarch, for example. But he also read Rollin, another great historian of the time, used to be very famous in the 18th century. Now, barely anybody talks about it anymore. But no, he read also books on botany and on agriculture and on music. I mean, this incredibly varied reading. And you're completely right in pointing out that he always carried, during his campaigns, campaign libraries. So specifically built really just large chests and boxes, which with specifically binded books that fit into them. And he carried into battle, you know, sometimes one, sometimes 8,000 books. Right. And but he also built in all of his palaces and residences these great libraries, these consular and then imperial libraries, which over time came to hold over 60,000 volumes.
Wow.
And at some point, we know he even had even greater ambitions. He wanted to get a copy of every book published in Europe transferred to these libraries. I mean, he wanted to collect all of the world's knowledge for him and his court and his ministers to and his princes to draw upon. I mean, his ambition when it comes to literature and history was huge. I mean, you thought his military ambition was bad. He wanted a copy of every book published in Europe, in Sweden, in Denmark, in Germany, in Italy. I mean, this was gargantuan.
Right.
And that, I mean, he was the most literary monarch we've ever seen in France, and I would argue the world.
Yeah.
He's the first French monarch to portray himself in front of libraries in his official portraits.
Yeah.
I mean, so he was a great bibliophile and a great lover of books. And that's what I really wanted to study in my book.
Yeah. Let's kind of dive into this and kind of figure out how he got into this. Because I know two things. Like, he really got into books when he was sent off to military school in France, where basically he didn't know anyone, not even the language. Right. It was almost like those were his only friends, the books.
Yeah, very much so. So he goes to first a little college in Autun where he learns French, only stays there for about 3 months, and then moves on to Brienne-le-Château, the military academy, the Royal Military Academy at Brienne. And you're perfectly right in pointing out he spoke with a very thick Corsican accent. He was the only Corsican there for a time. I think there was another Corsican kid who joined him, but basically he was alone. In the face of these French aristocratic kids who were very hostile to him, he was a very strong Corsican patriot at the time, actually detested the French, thought they had invaded his country, which they had. Mm-hmm. So a huge fan of Pascal Paoli, the great hero of Corsican independence.
Yep,
exactly. So that did not exactly endear him to the French aristocratic kids he was at school with.
Right.
He also had a different skin color. They said he had an olive skin color. And his mother was the subject of rumors about her alleged infidelity to the Comte de Marbeuf, the governor of Corsica. Yeah. So all of this creates sort of this perfect cocktail in which he's taken apart by the other kids and bullied. Today we would call it bullying. And so what does he do? He falls into books and they never leave him. And he reads voraciously, starting at that point, perhaps a little before, but really starting at the point. And then that love really never leaves him.
So I think another interesting aspect is not only did he read books, but early in his revolutionary career, did he write a melodramatic book or something like that?
Multiple. He wrote many things of very varying quality. So he writes essays, very teenagey adolescent essays. So he wrote, for example, an essay on suicide. He says, "Where are my thoughts turned to today on death?" And about how horrible his life is and how emotional he is and how next time he walks by a carriage, he quotes, might not want to get out of its way. I mean, very weird, some melodramatic, you know, hormone-fueled adolescent writing.
Right.
He writes a little essay about the time he lost his virginity. He finds this woman in the street, a prostitute at the Palais Royal. He goes up to her and he bombards her in typical Napoleonic style. But what are you doing here? Why do you do this job? Who has done this to you? Why must you? Don't you want to get a better job? And she has to tell him, "Sir, don't you want to, you know, move on to something?" And he just bombards her with questions. I mean, he's such an awkward guy, especially with women.
Right.
And then he writes some short stories. He writes a short story called New Corsica, which is this bloodlust, blood-filled revenge fantasy. About a Corsican man who sees his daughter killed by French troops, and he goes on a killing spree of Frenchmen, murdering Frenchmen, including children, to avenge Corsica and his daughter. He writes a very weird short story about a Muslim prophet that it poisons all of his followers. It probably copied or plagiarized off of Voltaire's play Mahomet, also called Fanaticism. And perhaps his greatest literary production is Clisson and Eugénie, which you might have been referencing.
Yeah.
And Clisson and Eugénie is a love story about Clisson, who's a very poorly disguised Napoleon, sort of a very brave young soldier who's respected by his comrades and does everything for country and goes off to war and learns that Eugénie, his wife, for reasons we are not told, is cheating on him with his best mate. And then heartbroken, he throws himself into the fray and dies.
Oh, wow.
That's the story. As I said, varying quality. He also enters an essay contest at some point and submits a discourse on happiness, he calls it. Again, completely plagiarized, this time off of Rousseau. He was very proud of it. He worked for months on his essay, and he did not win the prize of the essay contest, which he was much distraught. But when he grew older, he knew that what he had written was very bad. We have a moment, a quite delightful moment, when I think it was during the consular years, Talleyrand walks into his office. Talleyrand, always savvy, you know, always moving around, always tactful, had found the Discours de Lyon, had found his essay contest.
And if there was going to be one man in France to find it, it would have been him, with all the connections.
Would have been him, and he shows it to Napoleon, and Napoleon, embarrassed, immediately thrusts it into the fire. don't say a word about this, you know.
Right.
So he knew that his writing was not the best.
Well, I think people get, you know, people just assume that just because you're a tactical military genius, then you're going to be genius in other realms. You know, just because Beethoven's a genius on the piano doesn't mean he's a genius when it comes to writing literary works of art. So Napoleon, you know, probably did his best in that time frame, but realized he wasn't very good at it. But we'll roll into this. what I like about him is he didn't mind surrounding himself with really smart people, especially the campaign in Egypt, correct?
Yeah, so that's another episode I study in great detail in the book, because this is such a typical, a typically Napoleonic thing that he does. I guarantee you, if it would have been Menou who headed the Egyptian expedition, you would not have had the 160 or 170 savants brought along. So he goes to Egypt, he's 27 or 28 years old, and he brings with him the largest fleet ever to sail the Mediterranean, 40,000 soldiers, 10,000 sailors. And who does he also bring along? He brings along balloonists and cartographers and engineers and poets and painters and sculptors and antiquarians and botanists and biologists. I mean, these wonderful scientists that he brings along, and creates in Egypt the Institut d'Egypte, the Institute of Egypt, for the purposes of unlocking the country culturally and scientifically. And I mean, their impact is huge. I mean, they pretty much create modern Egyptology.
Yeah.
Of course, the discovery of the Rosetta Stone leads to the decryption of the hieroglyphs. They pretty much discover archaeology. I mean, so many ventures are born out of this clearly evident wish by him to focus on culture and the arts and literature and the sciences.
Right. And what 27-year-old, even today, would have had the foresight to bring all these other, you know, geniuses along with him? I mean, that's just amazing to me.
Yeah. And I can tell you where he probably got the idea. He was a great fan of Plutarch and read Plutarch's Lives religiously, and was also a great fan of Alexander the Great. It was his great hero, Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar. And what had Alexander the Great done when he conquered Egypt? He brought along 100 or so philosophers.
Right.
And what had Alexander done? He went to the shrine in Egypt and got accepted by the local gods and pronounced a policy of integration and a policy of tolerance to local Moors. And Napoleon imitates that perfectly in Egypt with his approach to Islam, with his army, and his approach to the locals. You know, he celebrates. Can you imagine a French colonial army with the regimental band plays a great ceremony for the birthday of the prophet?
Yeah.
He funds the building of mosques. He orchestrates and accompanies pilgrims to go to Mecca.
Yeah.
He writes how he to his soldiers. He issues translated version of the Quran to his soldiers.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
I mean, this is an amazing thing for the time and for his age.
Yeah, and what I think is interesting is, despite all the hardships in Egypt, and they had many, you know, they had obviously many battles with the Mamluk warriors, with the British. They had a bout of plague. They had a couple bad sieges. And Napoleon, despite all that, said his time in Egypt was amongst the happiest of his life.
Of course. You know. That's completely understandable. He also probably says this 20 years later when he's dying and depressed and has lost everything. One can see why. I mean, he tells at some point his secretary that all the great reputations were built in the Orient, that Europe is but a molehill. And he had dreams. Now, we know they're dreams, completely unfeasible and impossible. But he had dreams of, you know, establishing a French colony in Egypt and then taking his army and marching to India.
Right.
And to submit, just like following Alexander. I mean, this guy was so obsessed with history and so deluded in a way. I mean, it has to be, I mean, a small inkling of delusion to think that he could follow in the footsteps of Alexander. I don't know what's worse, that he thought that or that he almost did.
Yeah.
He almost managed to, I mean, this is just an amazing, amazing story.
Yeah, that is. And I do want to talk about, you know, taking an idea and reading it is one thing, but applying it is another thing. Now, we were talking before the call about the core systems and massing batteries. And basically, military thought that was already on paper, but what did Napoleon do with that thought?
Yeah, so it turns out that if you read a very influential strategic military treatise of the time that is, again, completely forgotten today, but, you know, made a lot of waves when it was published, was Jacques-Antoine Hippolyte de Guibert's Traité Stratégique, published when Napoleon's 3 years old. And de Guibert was a very renowned military mind, and had conversed with Frederick the Great, et cetera, very well reputed. Madame de Staël, in fact, wrote a little tract praising him and his thinking at the time. So he publishes this thing, and we know Napoleon read it. And in it, you find many of the things that would later embody the Napoleonic style of warfare. Mm-hmm. So as you said, the importance of a fast pace, of a fast army, that marching is much more important than fighting. The importance of having adequate logistics, even at the cost of reducing the size of an army. The importance of relying on draft measures, on creating national armies instead of on foreign mercenaries and aristocrats. I mean, basically the tenets of the core system are found in Guibert. Now, as you rightly point out, you had to have a Napoleon to take these ideas and implement them on a large scale. And this is really, I mean, it's true with Guibert and the core system, but it's true with so many other things. So many people have had, I mean, this is the director of the Fondation Napoléon, Thierry Lenz, said this. I thought it was so funny and so true. He says, you know, everybody during the directory had the good idea. Oh, let's make Lycée. What a good idea. Nobody does it. Oh, let's make a civil code for all of France. Great idea. Nobody does it. And then Napoleon comes, and his reign is the reign of the serious, as Thierry Lenz has said. When he has an idea, he implements it. He puts funding behind it. He puts people in a room and he says, you're not getting out until you get things done. And he sets the course. And then the thing gets done. The lycées get opened. The code gets compiled. The core system gets implemented that never would have happened under anybody else. I mean, he is the incarnation of action. And we're not going to deliberate for 6 years, right? You get an idea and then you act. You plan it out. Now, whether you disagree with the idea, I mean, and you may willing to on any of his ideas, he had some horrible ideas. But what you cannot take away from him is that he acts. He does. He really does this. And this is true in 1800 when he takes power, and it's true in 1814. I mean, always the religion of action.
Yeah, and if you were a general or a bureaucrat for that matter, and you weren't acting to his speed, you were usually sacked or removed, you know? And
absolutely, yeah. Actually, no,
it's just fascinating to me. And you touched on the Code of Napoleon. And again, those were ideas that were out there, but no one had enacted them into law. And he kind of pulled it all together like that.
He did. And he also benefited from Cambaceres, obviously, who was also a genius. And I was having this conversation with a friend of mine who said this wonderful phrase. It's so true. He says, yes, Napoleon is a star, but around them, there are planets. And I mean, in just this was a golden generation, militarily and in the civil world. I mean, you had geniuses in France operating at around this time. And he really benefited from them. But you're right, of course, he is the great actor. He gets the people in a room. He sponsors Cambaceres. He sits down all the people. He collects all of the books of the differing legal traditions in France in the great library of the Conseil d'État. He hires librarians to compile these libraries so that his counselors may have these legal texts to draw upon. And they set to work and they do it. And today, I mean, half of the laws still on the books in France are from the code. Half.
Isn't it amazing?
In 2023.
Yeah, and in other countries too.
Of course, in South America. I mean, there are whole schools studying the impact of the Napoleonic Code on South America only. And in other countries in Europe. I mean, it just, this is what's so amazing about him. He was a military genius. Even if it was just military, it would be amazing to study him and he would take up some pages in the history books. But then you had the political aspects and you had the civil aspects and you had the cultural aspects and you had the intellectual aspect and the literary aspects. And it is just keeps on giving. I mean, it's he was a tornado. I mean, he was a vortex, reforming everything, changing everything, acting on everything. And again, the guy was full of faults. I mean, we can't dodge these questions. I mean, he did mess it all up at the end, but Chateaubriand called him, Chateaubriand, who was not his ally, by the way, Chateaubriand, who was a great opponent of his, called him the greatest breath of life that ever animated human clay.
Yeah.
And he was just, Andrew Roberts calls him the Enlightenment on horseback. It was an amazing, amazing person. Yeah. Very weird person, but amazing nonetheless.
Yeah, I think even Winston Churchill called him the most able man in history.
Yeah. Greatest man of action.
But I like what you said, that, you know, he was the star, but there's planets around him. And even, like you said, Talleyrand, Cambaceres, but even in other countries, Metternich, Clausewitz, there were some generals that were, or marshals, Saint-Cyr, Massena, Davout. There were some really smart men that hovered around him.
Oh, absolutely. Davout especially. And even if they weren't always the most loyal, I'm thinking especially of Talleyrand, they were incredible people. I just finished a biography of Talleyrand, and you know, my view of him completely changed over these past few years. Yes, he betrays Napoleon, but was he betraying France? I don't know. I mean, Talleyrand orchestrates one of the greatest diplomatic coups in human history.
Yeah.
By basically convincing the Allies in 1814 that for the past 15 years, they waged war on one man and not on France. So after the first abdication, you have no indemnity of war. You have no occupation of France. And France has returned to her 1796 borders, which made her larger than she ever was in history.
Yeah.
After losing basically a world war, those are not pretty bad odds, pretty bad terms.
No, those are great terms. And,
amazing. And of course, after there's the 100 days and everything is screwed up. And it's a great catastrophe is the 100 days. It's great for the legend,
right.
Terrible for history.
Yeah, indeed. And for France.
And for France.
This episode is brought to you by Intuit, the technology platform that brings financial confidence with products like TurboTax, Credit Karma, QuickBooks, and MailChimp. You might have learned the recorder in school, but probably not how to navigate the financial world. Luckily, Intuit's on a mission to help with the free Intuit for Education program. It provides students with the lessons to learn essential skills, like how to build credit, file taxes, and budget. Check out their free resources at intuit.com/education.
But yeah, let's kind of dive into kind of his legacy, because obviously I don't want to walk through every step of his career. In France, what do you think his legacy is? Obviously, there's monuments to him, obviously Arch de Triomphe and all these other things that he built. But what is the feeling of him by your everyday Frenchman?
Yeah, so there was a great line by Jean Tullard where he said that, you know, every few generation or so, people rediscover him through the light of their own values and mores. So whatever's going on in your society, you reread Napoleon and you rediscover, oh, what's his attitude on slavery? What's his attitude on sexism? What's his attitude on colonialism? So we look at him through the prism of our own values. Mm-hmm. And we saw this very clearly for the bicentennial. The past couple of years, we had big ceremonies in France. We had a lot of shows covering his legacy. And the major topics, unfortunately, were the great controversies. The reinstitution of slavery, obviously, but also sexism and colonialism. So I would say the legacy now is a very ambivalent one. Mm-hmm. It's a very controversial one, even though in my view, it shouldn't be at all. Mm-hmm. But this is what we're left with. But it's good because it allows, you know, people like you and me and historians more generally to come out of their dusty boxes once in a while, to come back to the TV shows and the podcasts and discuss these things, to try to get the public to understand them a little deeper.
And I think it's important to have that dialogue. And I'm glad you brought that up.
Of course. Absolutely. I mean, it's conversation is all we have.
Yeah.
And I don't exactly know what else there is. I mean, this is history. I mean, what are people afraid of?
Right.
I mean, yes, he reinstituted slavery. Yes, he has unsavory remarks. Yes, he has questionable views on women. He was born in the 1760s. What exactly do people expect from somebody born in the 1760s? I mean, I don't exactly know what the fear is here. What historical figure passes that test then? Which one, which epoch, which culture, which individual matches the morality we have attained in the last 10 or 20 years? I mean, nobody. I mean, does that mean we can't study history? We can't look up to some achievement? No, we take the good and we discuss the bad.
Right.
That's what we have to do with him and with everybody else. And when it comes to him, especially for French men and women, it's more important because his handprint is everywhere in modern France. I mean, he is the creator of modern France, basically. Mm-hmm. Everything that is around today is pretty much attributable to him. So we must be able to discuss. I quite enjoyed the speech of President Macron during the bicentennial. But I saw another article the other day on the speech, and it said the ceremony was meant to commemorate, not celebrate Napoleon. Mm-hmm. Ah, this is journalism in all its splendor now. Commemorate, but not celebrate.
Right.
We can't celebrate. If Frenchmen can't celebrate Napoleon, then no nation should celebrate anybody.
Yeah.
He is the architect of the nation.
Of course. And that kind of leads me into the new Napoleon movie, of course, created by a British man, an Englishman, which I did not like. I did not hate. I thought the costume design was good and the sets were good. And I just, obviously I like any production on Napoleon because it brings attention not only to my podcast, but to the era.
Of course.
What was your feeling on it?
I thought it was atrocious. I really thought it was bad. I thought it was a bad movie. And let me just say, to be perfectly clear, I don't think it was bad because it was historically accurate. Ridley Scott has said quite rightly, don't get your history from movies. Get your history from books and documentaries and great podcasts like this one.
Right.
I am perfectly willing to give full artistic license to directors and to movies and to actors. I mean, no problem. I mean, just in Ridley Scott's past productions, Gladiator is full of mistakes.
Yeah.
Wonderful movie.
Yeah.
Kingdom of Heaven. Oh, my God. Kingdom of Heaven, to me, is a masterpiece.
Right.
It is an amazing movie.
Right.
Full of mistakes, full of liberties. It doesn't matter. It's a great movie.
Braveheart has nothing to do with history, almost nothing to do with history, but it's a fantastic movie.
Fantastic movie, pure fiction.
Yep.
Fantastic movie. Napoleon manages to be both a bad movie and fiction. I'd be glad to hear your opinion on this. I thought first of all, there's no secondary character.
None. Josephine
and Napoleon. That's it. I mean, and just the dialogues are so bad. I mean, it's cringeworthy. The ridiculous sex scenes. I mean, when he says at dinner, I don't know if you remember this. To me, this was the crowning moment of the movie. He says, "I enjoy my meals. Destiny has brought me this lamb chop."
Right. I laughed.
What? Destiny has brought me this lamb chop?
Right.
The greatest man of action in European history. And this is what we have in a $180 million production. Destiny has brought me this lamb chop. Is this a joke? I mean, this is insane.
Yeah.
I mean, this man was so energetic, so charismatic. He was wooing thousands. I mean, millions of soldiers ran to their deaths in his name because he inspired them. So Josephine was crazy about him. He enthused an entire nation and hypnotized the generation. And we get Destiny brought me this lamb chop. I mean, I thought Phoenix played him very badly.
Yeah.
And again, I think Phoenix is a great actor, but I think Phoenix himself has said in an interview, I got to the set. I didn't know how to play him.
Right.
And I think that shows Napoleon was a
winner. He can act clearly.
Of course, he's a great actor. He's an amazing actor. But Napoleon was a Mediterranean, wearing his emotions on his sleeve. Constantly, people who talked with him felt this bubbling energy under the ice, you know, ready to surface, ready to explode. Phoenix plays him like he's dimwit, no emotion except when he cries two or three times in his handkerchief. I also thought the battles, by the way, were a disappointment.
Yeah, like, you know, they show none of his strategic genius. They don't show him inspiring his troops or laughing with them by the campfire. Nothing. Like, they were awful.
No, and even just the design. I mean, again, Thierry Lenz, I'm citing him again, but he's a good authority on this, as it turns out. He says the battles resembled those of the TV show Vikings, which I thought is spot on. I mean, mass charges, no discernible formations.
Yep.
And this leads me to another great mystery. Why has no Hollywood director understood what a cavalry charge is?
Yeah.
I mean, this loose order formation charging as a mob is insane. I mean, the cavalry charge to me is what lends itself the best to the cinema, to cinematography.
Right.
I mean, that is just waiting for a director to know what he's talking about to make such. I mean, we have people in the records dying of heart attacks from seeing a cavalry charge. I mean, the earth trembled, the thousands of horsemen shoulder to shoulder.
Right.
I mean, charging together, the screams, the clank of metal, the shot ricocheting off. I mean, the scenes were epic.
Yeah, moving.
Epic.
And scary as heck. Is absolutely
terrifying, tragic, beautiful, everything you want. And what do we get in this movie? We get, I mean, at Waterloo, it's like a single line of like maybe like 100 horsemen. Bordino, that's all we have. We have four horses running around in a field. I thought Austerlitz, okay, slightly more horsemen, but still no organization. I mean, I don't know what it takes for somebody has to sit these directors down and explain to them how epic a cavalry charge was.
Yeah.
I mean, it could have been, of course, defining moments in battle. I'm thinking of the charge at Eylau, obviously, second greatest cavalry charge in human history, 10,000 horses, not even shown.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the second greatest cavalry charge in human history is not shown?
Yeah.
In a movie about Napoleon? What are these people doing? This is criminal.
I agree with everything you said. Yeah, and the last scene, which will kind of lead me into my next topic, where he's on St. Helena and he's watching two girls sword fighting with sticks, and then he just falls over like he's the godfather. Napoleon, when he was on St. Helena, he was working on his memoirs, and he was writing basically a public relations, his last, what did you call it, his last victory.
Right? Yeah, last victory against posterity, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
The one part about that scene that is true is that he does, in fact, question Betsy about the capitals of Europe.
Ah.
And he does say capital of Russia. And she does say St. Petersburg, it used to be Moscow. Why isn't it Moscow? Because I burned it. Well, sire, wasn't it the Russians who burned it? That we know that happened.
Yeah.
But apart from that, yeah, Keating over. I mean, it's part of the reason why Napoleon's story is so tragic and so moving is the exile. Of course, what he called his crown of thorns, which England makes me wear.
Yeah, it was Prometheus on a rock.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the ultimate martyrdom. Of course, he was cut off from everything. And as I try to show in the book, what he suffered most from probably on his island was his lack of books.
Yeah.
This is a very moving moment in his life. The man who benefited from libraries of 60,000 volumes couldn't get books. I mean, he tried everything he could to get books sent to him. And he does get some shipments, etc. But he arrives on St. Helena. He brought with him about 580 books.
You know, it's funny you mention that. I didn't even think about how that might have affected his mental state. And he doesn't have access to literary geniuses, scientific geniuses, all the mathematic geniuses that surrounded him in France. Like you said, he's St. Helena. So he doesn't have those new ideas coming to him anymore.
Well, that's what he says to Sir Hudson Lowe. So he arrives on St. Helena. He has 580 books. Of course, that is just chronically insufficient for such a voracious reader. Mm-hmm. He reads through them in a matter of weeks or a couple months. And he has to wait 16 months until the next shipment of books arrives. It arrives aboard HMS Newcastle, ironically, on the one-year anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo, the ship docks on St. Helena. And he gets crates of these books sent up to Longwood House, and he's so excited. He's so beside himself with joy to get new books that he grabs scissors and hammers himself to open the boxes. Now, this may sound like a trifling episode, but at the time, for the emperor to open the boxes himself is unheard of. That does not happen.
But the way that you describe it, it's almost like a hungry man in the desert, you know, getting food at last. Like,
that's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And he stays up all night reading them. Marchand tells us that the next morning he walks into Napoleon's room at 7 a.m. and sees him. He hasn't slept and he has all the books open on the floor and on the bed. And he read them with the thumb, as he said. And he's so excited to discover all the new books, etc. But he is very heartbroken to find out that he already has many of the books in the shipment. And so he tells Lowe, and this is the books is a major reason why their relationship deteriorated. He tells Lowe, I have 1,000 volumes. This is insufficient for me. I need 60,000 volumes and the resources of a great city.
Mm-hmm.
Because 60,000 is the number of books he had in his many imperial libraries. So a very, very touching moment in St. Helena. Of course, the slow death with the horrible disease, the stomach cancer, the depression. Gradually, some of his companions leave him. The friends he made on the island leave him. And the end is the most tragic part. And it's very touching when you read, you know, his last few weeks. He was completely, of course, completely disappearing mentally.
Right.
And he had this obsession to still control, still understand everything. He asks Bertrand, who's beside his bed, as he's dying, you know, who left the island today? What goods came in? What goods left? Mm-hmm. Who is still on the island? How many months does it take for them to get back to France? I mean, desperately, his mind was desperately trying to hang on, to stay alive, to still control, to still understand. And of course, dies completely alone, neglected. People in France had mostly forgotten him.
Yeah.
And it's very, very tragic.
Yeah, let's touch on that because this is the last topic I wanted to talk about was December 15th, 1840, which is what, almost two decades later.
Yeah, just about.
He's returned to France by King Louis-Philippe, who's kind of a different ruler than the Bourbons, but his, I guess his popularity is kind of waning. So he thinks, well, we'll get Napoleon from St. Helena, and we'll give him an official state funeral.
Yep.
And the amount of people who turn up in awful weather, it's freezing cold out. Does that speak to his legacy? I mean, it's really, truly remarkable, especially his old marshals who are old and stooped over. Dr. Larry is there.
Yep.
All these bureaucrats are there that used to work for him. They line the streets. I mean, that's just as moving and as evoking as you can get.
It really is a moving episode, undeniably. Of course, the king brings him back under the influence of Adolphe Thiers, who himself was a historian of the period. And there's also this wish, you know, we had done the revolution, we had done the consulate and empire, and then we did away with that. The kings came back, we did the restoration, and now the restoration was gone too. And we were the Orléans. So there was a very gray zone. What do we do with the heritage of the revolution? Is it too soon to deal with it? Are we past it? Should we just forget it? And so the return of the ashes is very much a wish by the government to sort of to put a bow on it. Mm-hmm. Now we reintegrate the revolution. We reintegrate Bonaparte, which is its main product. And now we move on. And of course, it's a ploy for popularity as well. And what happens when the corpse arrive, as you said, I mean, you get, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not a million people on the streets. Mm-hmm. Now, it's very important. And I must point out, sorry to burst the bubble there a little bit, but by the time of Napoleon's death, he was not very popular in France.
Right.
And people were acutely aware that when he came back during the 100 days, it was a catastrophe for the country. After the first abdication, Talleyrand masterfully negotiates no war indemnity, no occupation of France. France returned to her 1796 borders and reintegrates the Council of Europe.
Right.
So almost as if nothing had happened. But when he comes back and is again defeated at Waterloo, now there is a price to pay.
Right.
Now there is occupation of the territory, and the Prussians and the Austrians and the Russians will occupy and do great damage to France. Now there's a massive war indemnity to pay.
Right.
Now we are amputated of the Low Countries, and many other provinces, and to the strengthening of Austria and Prussia.
Right.
So it's really a catastrophe for France. And regular French people were acutely aware that when this guy came back, there was war. Mm-hmm. And there was conscription again,
yep,
which grew hugely unpopular,
yeah,
by the end of his reign. People were tired of it. But so he goes away, he dies, and of course then publishes in 1823 the Memorial of St. Helena, mm-hmm, which is the last battle and the last victory against posterity. It's this great semi-memoir, semi-invention dictated to the Count of Las Casas, mm-hmm, the Count of Las Casas, who's his companion on St. Helena, published by Las Casas in 1823. It's basically journal entries of conversations he had with the emperor, what the emperor did, what the emperor said during, mm-hmm, the first year on St. Helena. Mm-hmm. And it portrays Napoleon as this great liberal monarch who cared about liberty, who cared about nationalism, the great champion of these ideas. Of course, he was not that at all. But right, by 1840, people had the memorial was so popular, so many people had read it, and nostalgia had kicked in that the legend was in full swing.
Yeah,
it was the first great iteration of the legend. So that's why also people came out in droves. They had forgotten the bad. They'd forgotten the conscription. They'd forgotten all the incessant wars and the war indemnities and the occupation. And they still had the nostalgia, and they just had the legend through the Memorial of St. Helena, which had been created by Las Casas. So this also explains, unfortunately, why so many people turned out. But don't let this fact take away from the very real fact also that his impact on France had been huge, and people knew that, especially his old marshals. I mean, Bertrand was so moved,
yeah,
when he saw the tomb again that he couldn't put the sword on it. When the king said, okay, I accept this tomb on behalf of France, General Bertrand lay the conqueror's sword by his side. Bertrand was so consumed with emotion, he couldn't do it.
Yeah, no, that is an amazing story. There were seven marshals still alive. Three were probably, not invited: Victor, Marmont, and Bernadotte. The four who attended, Grouchy, Soult, Oudinot, and Moncey.
Yeah.
And I think Moncey's one is very interesting because he was basically on death's door. And he told his doctor, please keep me alive until Napoleon's remains get back to France.
Of course. Well, and this is also true for the savants. Years after the Egyptian expedition, they referred to themselves affectionately as the Egyptians, the savants who had come back. I mean, people knew perfectly well that, I mean, even if it wasn't true at the time, in retrospect, that what they had lived with them was the greatest adventure of their lives. Mm-hmm. And how could you not? I mean, there's so much history compressed in those 2 decades.
Yeah.
More history happens in those 20 years than in other countries happen in centuries.
Yeah. And you almost, they must have known, clearly, even the marshals and even the regular foot soldier knew we were making history here. We're doing something no one's ever done before.
Of course. Yeah. As he incessantly told them in his many declarations. Mm-hmm. Another sort of funny and very weird anecdote, right before the Battle of the Pyramids, you know, he issues this proclamation to his soldiers, you know, saying, soldiers, 40 centuries look down upon you from these pyramids.
Right.
It's an enduring mystery how Napoleon correctly guessed the age of the pyramids 60 years before an actual modern excavation was done on the pyramids. He was off by like 2 centuries.
Right.
The pyramids are like 42 or 43 centuries old. And it's something about his luck and his star and, of course, his incessant reading of history. But it's just one of the other enduring mysteries. But you're perfectly right. He tells them, you know, you're making history here. I mean, you are following the footsteps of the legions of Rome.
Yeah.
And of course, it's propaganda. Of course, it's the legend. But there is a grain of truth.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. And Let's summarize here what we've learned. You're never too busy to read a book, right?
That's right. Or 60,000.
Right, or 60,000. You can always take a crack at writing a book, but that doesn't make you a good author.
Oh, God. Okay. We know that only too well.
Yeah, exactly. Although I'm very excited to read your book, which I cannot wait. Napoleon's Library and Legacy.
Sure. And also, I would tell your listeners, if I may be allowed, that they're fully able to pre-order the book right now.
Oh.
All they have to do is go on Pen and Sword's website. In fact, if you just type into, it's not on Amazon yet, it will be within a month or two. But if you just, to be sure, go on Google and type Napoleon's Library and my name, Louis Sarkozy, you will find it. It's on Pen and Sword's website. You can pre-order it right now, and it should be delivered in May or June.
Yeah, I just added it to my basket here in the cart. So
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem. And are you planning to do more books on Napoleon? Or what's obviously, I'm sure you just got done with this one, but what are next steps for you?
Well, you know, John, this book was much of an effort to get him out of my system.
A labor of love.
Yeah. Indeed. I've been studying this man and reading about him for some years now, and I wanted to say something long form to be published, to sort of move on to something else. Now, of course, as you know, as the host of this great podcast, one never really moves away from Napoleon.
That's right.
He always stays a part of you. But afterwards, I think I may be writing on another subject. I think I will be writing about my other great love, which is the United States.
Oh, wow.
And I think I may be able to write a history of the United States. It's not exactly sure what angle we'll be able to take here, but we're in discussions.
All right. Well, I can't wait to read that one as well.
I appreciate that.
More on Louis, they can find you on Twitter, obviously, because that's how you and I found each other. Is there a website or should they focus just on Pen and Sword or what would you like to?
Yeah, I mean, I'll encourage people to reach out to my Twitter account, which is Louis Sarkozy. Mm-hmm. I think the handle is NAP, the first 3 letters of Napoleon, NAP Sarkozy. Mm-hmm. I also have a website, which is louissarkozy.org. But again, you'll be able to find that on my Twitter. Yeah, so I don't have any social media. It's just a Twitter for the book. So that's where you'll find me.
Perfect. Well, I appreciate you coming on the podcast. I learned a lot. And I recommend all my listeners go check out Napoleon's Library by Louis Sarkozy.
I appreciate that, John. Thank you so much. It was great to be with you. Thank you for the invitation and the conversation.